Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, according to John Key, because everybody now can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is Sarah Miles, and I believe she's coming in from New Zealand as well. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vincent. Yes, I'm in the earthquake-torn city of Christchurch. It's a beautiful day today, and great to talk to you.
All right. Glad to hear that your voice isn't too shaky.
No. Are you hearing me loud and clear?
Just nicely. As loud and clear as a 6.4.
7.1, actually.
Yeah, those are nasty too.
Indeed. Yeah. Great to have the opportunity to talk to you. I should probably let your readers or your listeners know that I wrote the book, The Christchurch Fiasco, The Insurance Aftershock and Its Implications for New Zealand and Beyond. And I wrote that book as a response to some of the difficulties that we were encountering post the earthquakes, with particular reference to the insurance industry and the government response to events here in Christchurch.
That's actually something I mentioned on the show yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Just coincidentally. Would you be able to turn your speakers down a little bit? It's feeding back a tiny bit.
Let me see.
Just turn down your volume. Should be straightforward. That's perfect. No feedback. Okay. Well, just to give the listeners a little bit of a heads up, you know, the Christchurch earthquake, this is the irony about it to me, Sarah, is that the government is touting it as the key to economic recovery, the Christchurch rebuild. Everybody's making money from the Christchurch rebuild. And so I theorize, well, whenever we're in an economic crisis, why don't we just blow up a city and rebuild it?
Well, certainly natural disasters would fall into the same category as war zones in that respect. And you know, normally a war zone is a perfect catalyst to get an economy back on its feet. So I suppose you could argue that indeed post-torn natural disaster environment is a good environment in which to stimulate the economy. Whether or not you're implying that this was created purposefully, well, you know, the jury's still out on that one. And I'm not really here to propose that it was, but that's certainly one of the theories that you hear around the place.
Yeah, we've had a number of investigative journalists on the show that have noted things of a suspicious nature, like the fact that the army was, they had 1,000 troops in Lyttelton Harbour, not like 20 minutes drive from the city on the day of the quake, doing emergency disaster relief drills, you know,
yes.
A whole bunch of convenient coincidences like that. the 9 US congressmen who were here on the day, and the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency as well, who stayed behind. I think maybe 2 hours before the quake hit, all the congressmen jumped on the plane and went home, and the Federal Emergency Manager guy who manages disasters stayed behind.
And, yes,
you know, all sorts of things like that. But are you aware of these?
Absolutely, yes. But since writing the book, I've talked to many, many hundreds or thousands of people, and I've heard probably everything there is to hear about, you know, what it may be a result of or what it may not be as a result of. But I have to say that my own personal opinion is, all of those theories aside, the post-disaster recovery, which is really my focus of interest, has not gone as well as one would have hoped. So I'm not really here today to talk about what may or may not have been the cause of the earthquakes, but rather, you know, the events that have taken place post-earthquake and how the state of Canterbury, really, and the state of the people of Canterbury.
Now, didn't the Environment Canterbury get forcively replaced by Dame Margaret Baisley not too long before the quake as well?
Yes, that's also correct, yeah. Yeah, but you
now,
know,
how did Environment Canterbury react to the disaster as it came through? I mean, because I was wondering if there was lots of contractors involved. You know, where's all the money coming from for the rebuild? That kind of thing. I'd love it if you could just elucidate, and I'll just shut up for a second.
Well, there's been. I haven't heard much from Environment Canterbury. There's been a lot of discussion about the loss of our democratic rights post-earthquake, and Environment Canterbury was seen as one of those losses. In terms of the events since its disbandment, one really doesn't hear much about Environment Canterbury, you know, apart from the fact that the population bemoans its loss.
That's strange. Well, I think we're still getting a bit of feedback. If you could turn your speakers down just a little bit more.
Okay.
Sorry.
How's that?
Technical difficulties. Testing. It's all G. Okay.
So, you know, the reason I wrote the book was because I was very deeply concerned about the events that were taking place here, and I was absolutely furious at the way in which the insurance industry was dealing with, or my insurer, IAG, was dealing with our claim, or rather not dealing with our insurance claim. And as the process has gone on post-earthquakes, what I've seen is that, when there's no longer government for the people and by the people, we're seeing things like the introduction of charter schools, or the mooted introduction of charter schools in Canterbury and throughout the rest of the country. Now, this is something that the majority of people simply don't want, and yet we see the national government sort of trying to push this upon a population that clearly doesn't want charter schools. So there's a sense that we're being, our voices are being increasingly muzzled, or at least our opinions are being less and less listened to.
Broadcast.
Sorry, what was that?
All of the opinions that just aren't getting broadcasted.
Well, I think they're broadcast, but they're just ignored. You know, there's no participatory decision-making any longer. I would argue that, you know, there's too much power in the hands of only a few, and certainly here in Christchurch, I think there's a feeling amongst many that the government has been supporting the insurance industry to the detriment of the people of Canterbury. In writing the book, I wanted to inform the rest of the country about the things that were happening here, because certainly the media doesn't focus enough attention or enough time on the plight of the people. And the reality is there are still at least 200,000 people in Christchurch who are affected by a lack of resolution of insurance claims, of still living in, you know, damaged houses or houses without water. In fact, I'm speaking to you from my place at the moment, which I don't live in. I'm happen to be here because I'm, you know, this is where I have access to Skype. But the 2.5 years on, many of us are still living in conditions that are less than satisfactory, and there's no end in sight.
Has this been causing a mass exodus of some kind?
I think there has been a very large exodus, and once again, you know, those are questions, quantifiable questions that we don't seem to be to get, you know, real answers to. There's a suggestion that only 14,000 people have left Christchurch. Well, you know, my feeling is the numbers are far, far greater than that. And they will continue to grow, because the more frustrated people get with trying to deal with insurers and watching the bureaucracy and what can only be described as corruption in Christchurch, you know, at the end of the process, you just can't wait to get out of the place. And I think there are many people in that category. In fact, last week alone, I spoke to about 10 different people who were in the process of moving out or planning to move on. And I can absolutely fully understand, you know, why people come to that conclusion or that motivation, yeah.
The question I also want to have on top of that, I mean, if lots of people are leaving, I mean, just from your personal experience being a long-time Christchurch resident, if you walk down one of the main streets or into the supermarket or something, is it noticeable that there's way fewer people than before?
Yeah, I think the traffic levels are down. Of course, there are less roads, and so there tends to be a higher density of traffic in certain parts of the city. But, for instance, you know, I go to yoga. There's a perfect example. And that's probably an age range of, you know, around the sort of late 20s to early 50s. And they've knocked back a number of classes because there simply aren't the people now that there were, you know, pre-earthquakes. So that's an indication. You start to see less people. And, you know, my husband belongs to one of the Rotary clubs there, and there are people leaving, you know. So I'm constantly reminded of the fact that, yeah, the place is thinning out. And understandably so, you know, there is no city centre, and it'll take a good 10 to 20 years to rebuild the infrastructure that was here previously. And for the elderly, who's got 10 or 20 years to wait? Or for the young people, there's nothing here to particularly keep them here. Although, of course, there's a really big drive to try and sell the city to the younger people. And, of course, there are tradespeople coming in all the time to rebuild the city. But we still have a massive labour shortage. That's another issue as well.
Mm. Now, in terms of insurance, this is the reason why you really wrote the book, and this is because of your personal experience with your insurance company, I'm sure, was a big motivating factor in all of this.
It was. Initially, it was the motivating factor. About a year after the event, I was struggling, I can only say that. I mean, I'm a lawyer by training, and I have a really good skill set in which you would imagine that I'd be able to resolve my own insurance claim. But here we are 2.5 years later, and it still isn't resolved. And so in September 2011, I started to write because, you know, as I talk to my neighbours, I live in an area not inside the city itself, but outside the city, in a place called West Melton, which was 6 kilometres from the epicentre of the first earthquake. So we really got a massive bang here, and many houses were damaged and quite a few destroyed. And just watching the way the insurers weren't dealing with me and listening to the stories of my neighbours, I decided that in my frustration and anger, I would start putting down on paper and doing some research as to what I saw occurring. And the reason for this was that it became very clear early on in the piece that what was happening was purposeful. You know, I think in the last 2.5 years, we've had 4 different offers ranging from, you know, 200,000 up to, we're up into the 850,000 at the moment. But you know, at any point, if a policyholder would accept one of those offers, then, you know, you'd be out of pocket by hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it becomes this really unpleasant, slow process of battling your private insurer. So I started to do research into insurance, and I have worked in the insurance industry myself in the past, but at a senior management level and not in claims capacity. So as I started to delve and talk and look in to the industry, what became clear was, well, a number of things. The fact that there are absolutely, you know, internal processes to make sure that this process takes place very slowly. And in so doing, you know, the insurance industry makes profits. So, you know, they deny or they reduce policyholders' claims. They refuse to pay market price for your property. They'll change policy coverage. You might have your own engineering report. They'll ignore your report or tell you that your engineering report doesn't state the facts. They'll simply wait until people give up, and people do give up because, you know, 2.5 years on, it really is a marathon and not a sprint. It takes a lot of energy to keep at it, to ensure that your interests and your rights are protected. I've seen them reduce payments using, you know, depreciation as an argument. They fail to properly investigate claims, or they over-investigate claims.
You know, Sarah, I apologise, but we're coming to break now, and I was just thinking, you know, we're going to need another whole segment, because I loved it how you were just laying out all of the things that they're doing, one after the other, dirty tactic, and it just seems like there's no end to it. So we've got another 15 minutes for you to finish the list. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Your daily dose of conspiracy and comedy is the Vinnie Eastwood Show. In a world so full of madness and chaos, don't lose your sense of humour or you'll go friggin' nuts. Weekdays 5 to 7 Central on American Freedom Radio.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Wherever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Rest assured, ladies and gentlemen, whatever you have heard before, I can guarantee you it'll happen again. Because history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but as a wise man said, it sure does rhyme. You ever heard of shock doctrine? Shock doctrine's great. Massive disaster happens, gives you all the excuses you want to come in, send in the troops, take everybody out of their homes and put them in FEMA trailers. Katrina, remind anybody of this? No? Well, Christchurch is a very interesting example. I think it's, as Sarah Miles said over the break, disasters bring out the best and the worst of people. And the type of things that are happening with the insurance companies, everybody's been in a job before that they didn't like the policies that were being set forth. but you couldn't really just quit your job, or maybe you hadn't had quite enough of this yet. And before quitting, you wind up doing a lot of damage to yourself because you have to sit there and you have to deny good people what they're actually entitled to when you're a good person and by your heart you want to help them. And so it weighs on your conscience. And so you have to find some way of dealing with it while you're continuing to do this job. Some people smoke, some people drink, some people eat. But apparently it is very much wearing on some of the employees of the insurance companies, and you can just imagine what it's doing to those who are actually being denied their insurance. Sarah Miles, welcome back.
Thanks, Vincent. Yeah, I was just thinking during when I was listening to the break, the word conspiracy came up there, and I had to sort of laugh to myself. And these days, conspiracy has almost come to mean the truth in many respects. We hear so little of the actual reality on the mainstream media these days, and I find it extraordinary that the word conspiracy is linked to essentially truth telling. I mean, I don't believe that what I'm telling you today falls into the category of conspiracy in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, this is my truth. This is the truth of many Cantabrians, and I wouldn't put it into the category of conspiracy. And I think it's sad that truth these days has become conspiratorial in many camps. Mm. So,
may I just inject something there? Because the technical definition of a conspiracy is two or more people coming together to cause harm on another group of people, without that group of people really being aware of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of things are conspiracies, even very simple crimes. And in fact, you know, conspiracy is a crime, right? You could be charged with conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit racketeering, you know, stuff like that. And the other interesting part about the term conspiracy theorist is that I think the person who first used it in public was a guy named Richard Milhouse Nixon. Over the Watergate affair, he says, I am innocent and those people are just conspiracy theorists, using it to demonize them. And it's been used ever since.
Yes.
I proudly call myself a conspiracy theorist because my definition of it is a person who believes that there's powerful people who have a lot of influence who use their power to maintain or grow their influence. And so that basically seems like the general running of society to me. People are always being conspired against, but
yeah. And I suppose you know, on that definition, I would say that indeed I see conspiracy happening in New Zealand currently, to my great sadness, really. In terms of the insurance industry, what I would say is that there are some great older insurance employees who are retired and who have come out and who are working for the people of Christchurch, who are not affiliated with any insurance companies and who have taken it upon themselves to go out there and assist the citizens of Christchurch. And of course, there are far too many of them to be able to make a massive difference, but there are a few who are certainly affecting the lives of tens and tens of Cantabrians in assisting them to help them work their way through the insurance quagmire. Yeah, and who have said to me that they're deeply embarrassed by what they see occurring within the insurance industry in Christchurch.
Now, in terms of this, that you're kind of pointing to the examples of some of the best people that come out in light of these disasters to, you know, help their fellow man. They're retired, they're not really in it anymore, but they can certainly help the process along. So they come out and they do it because they can. And also the insurance companies are also doing what they're doing because they can.
Mm,
who's holding them to account? Where are the authorities in all of this?
This was one of the major reasons for writing the book, because as I started to look around in order to assist my own insurance process, what I discovered was that actually there is no policyholder protection in New Zealand. And, I'm living in a city where there are people living in uninhabitable homes who've lost jobs, who are paying rates and mortgages and rent on top of temporary accommodation. There are people going broke. And you go as a policyholder, you go looking for somewhere to assist in helping you with your problem. And you quickly discover that, you're only, when you're talking about major natural disaster, and the average house price in Canterbury is now $400,000, if your house has been majorly damaged, you're looking at a sum of money, normally well over $200,000. And in that event, the district court is no longer available to you. You have to go to the High Court. And the fees involved in a High Court trial, you won't see any change from $70,000. And the average householder simply doesn't have $70,000 to throw at a High Court hearing. We do have an insurance and savings ombudsman, but that ombudsman is an industry-funded, so it's funded by the insurance industry. It's an industry-funded ombudsman, which in my opinion is not independent. You know, how can you have an independent ombudsman if it's funded by the industry? And the same
goes... I would say it depends on your position of independent, whether it's not dependent on other people or it's supposed to get other people independence.
Well, if you look at the statistics of claims heard and settled, I mean, I can't remember the exact statistics off my head, but I think in 2011, 14% of policyholders won their hearing at the ombudsman, as opposed to 67% of the insurance industry. So, you know, the statistics would indicate that the ombudsman definitely tends to favour the insurer over the homeowner. So there's absolutely no independent complaints process. The ability to have class actions in New Zealand is also not really a possibility. There's been a class action bill sitting waiting in the wings since 2009. And of course, insurance is a difficult case in point in that respect because, every insurance case tends to be quite different from the next one. So to bundle them all into one class action is quite complex. We don't have exemplary damages in this country or punitive damages, which are that's a way by which the court will, smack the insurer's hand and say, okay, because you've treated these people badly, we will fine you, if you like, an extra $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 as a result of the kind of behaviour we've been seeing perpetrated. In the US, exemplary and punitive damages are used widely, and some of the sums of money involved, I've seen exemplary damages of $1.5 million awarded against the insurer. So, you know, those are clear messages from government and the judiciary that we expect you to adhere to a certain standard of behaviour. And none of these things are available in New Zealand. So the poor old policy holder is at the mercy of these great big corporate giants who, because there are no limitations on the time frames within which they have to have settled a claim, they can just leave these, sitting in the wings for literally years and years and years. And, you know, my situation is also a case in point. I have been talking actively with our insurer since, I think it was, September the 9th, 2010. And yet here we are, we're still battling away.
It's ridiculous. Completely insane. Now, one would only not understand why this is happening if one weren't a sociopathic scumbaggery individual who has little interest in the common good of man, but has a lot of interest in lining his own pocket and, of course, ensuring that he himself doesn't go frickin' bankrupt. Because that's another thing that I found was very interesting about this whole Christchurch rebuild thing, is that a lot of these insurance companies were pleading poverty, like they couldn't afford to pay out and they would go bankrupt otherwise. Is that true?
There are a couple that have struggled, and that's because the legislation in New Zealand isn't tight enough. Our capital adequacy requirements are not stringent enough. Ansbar, which used to insure churches, they pulled out of the market because they simply didn't have enough money to cover the claims. And AMI, of course, which was a major Cantabrian policy holder, they also were going to fail as a consequence of not having enough capital adequacy, and they were purchased by IAG. So, and then, of course, there's Western Pacific, which was a Queenstown-based insurer, and they also ran out of money. So, yes, some of the smaller insurers have failed, and I noticed, I was reading the other day from the Reserve Bank where it was saying that in the event that any of these insurers do fail, there's no obligation by either the banks or the government to bail out policyholders. So if one of these insurers goes belly up, there is the potential that policyholders will be left out of pocket. And it's for that reason, and also for the reasons that I've been talking about, you know, the lack of good faith, the lack of sort of policyholder protection and reasonable dealings by the insurance industry with policyholders, that I feel that we should reintroduce a public insurer in this country. That we no longer need private insurers, but we start looking after ourselves.
Now, in terms of the people working for these companies who are making these decisions, somebody signed a piece of paper. There is a signature somewhere on a document saying, please don't give people their money. Don't instantly take their claims, give them the runaround, something to that effect. There must be something like that somewhere within company policy, wouldn't there?
Well, I'm not sure whether the claims staff on the bottom rungs are necessarily aware of senior strategy. But certainly in the dealings that I've had with our insurer, there's evidence of deliberate slowing the process down. Like you see words like, well, just write them a holding letter, you know, things like that. Yeah. I think
My point is, it appears to me to be a form of criminality to charge money for providing a service like, say, anything like insurance or whatever, to not do the job and then to wait out the people. I mean, that's like tantamount to me. That just sounds a lot like extortion to me, really. I mean, gangs do it to people all the time. People made that policy. Somebody within that company made the policy. But the problem is people don't get personally held accountable when you're taking a corporation to court. And there's nobody afraid of going to jail because all you're doing is wasting the company's money with several $100,000 fines or whatever, if that be. It's a really complicated situation. We'll be right back. Sarah Miles from Christchurch is my guest.
ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong
Welcome
with
back.
The world? People kill people.
Welcome back, people ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about keeping it bankster. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And my very special guest is Sarah Miles. Now, this is... I was trying to say over the break about, you know, just basically a person versus a corporation. You know, a person can act with criminality inside a corporation, and the worst thing that can really happen to them is they get fired, or maybe the corporation will get a few fines. In the meantime, people are literally suffering, and in some cases committing suicide and having their entire lives destroyed and things like that. It's tantamount to a criminal act of scumbaggery of untold proportions.
And yet, no doing anything about it.
No fracking accountability. That's what I don't get. Well, actually, I do get it because I happen to believe that the country is run by ruthless criminal sociopaths. And the evidence for that is astounding everywhere you look.
Yeah, and, you know, the other problem is that I think as a population, New Zealanders are really apathetic, and it won't be until New Zealanders stand up, you know, put their feet on the ground and say, actually, this is not what we want. This is not what we're about. We expect more accountability. We don't want charter schools. We want some policyholder protection so that if we are going to continue to run with the system, that there's some serious accountability, that when we see breaches of good faith by the insurance industry, that somebody's going to, you know, slap them on the hand and tell them that this is not the kind of behaviour we expect towards our population. We've paid our premiums and we expect more than this. And that's one of my great frustrations in Christchurch, is that people are suffering terribly, and yet it's very difficult to get a groundswell of public voice or public sentiment. There's a lot of fear here.
Can I offer another observation? Maybe the reason why you're not having quite so much of a groundswell of support is because having to go through this entire process has depressed the living hell out of people, and they can barely even bother to get out of the house, let alone get out and protest.
Yeah. Well, that's very true. It takes an incredible amount of energy to keep this battle up, and it is a battle. You know, you just getting information from EQC, which is the Earthquake Commission, you know, it takes months, and it's information that you're entitled to. The whole process is so terribly flawed.
Well, it's prone to letting people basically be out in the cold, like literally in Christchurch's case. Can we propose some solutions here? Have you come to conclusions from your books? What are the core problems? I mean, if you were Queen Elizabeth for a day, and you had the umpteen power and you could crack your scepter and just make it happen, what are the policy implementations that you would put in to protect people from having anything like this happen in the future? And secondly, maybe policies that would currently punish people who are perhaps guilty of any form of scumbaggery related to this case?
Well, I think there are several things. First of all, there needs to be regulatory change. We need to see oversight and transparency within the insurance industry. It's not good enough just having an insurance ombudsman funded by the industry. We need an insurance commissioner, somebody who is independent of the industry, who really has the policyholders' interests at heart. And we need, our insurance legislation is pretty weak in comparison with some of the things that they're proposing in Europe, like Solvency II legislation. We really just need to beef up our regulation. I think also that legislative change is required. We need a policy holder forum, somewhere to discuss how we might protect policy holders. you know, justice in this country is no longer affordable for the average family. $70,000 is not the kind of reasonable option if you have an issue with your insurer. I also think that there's been so much mucking around with building codes throughout this whole process. You know, the building codes have changed at least three times in the last 2.5 years to the benefit of the insurers and to the detriment of the equity in the property holders' equity. I think also that, you know, we've learned a lot about the nature of the land in Christchurch and the nature of the geology, if you like. And I think that all this information should, there should be a public database which is accessible to everybody in the country, and in which information about all parts of New Zealand are entered, so that when people are buying property or building houses, they can go and have a look at the various areas and make you know, clever choices about where they build, you know, clearly with the tsunami risk, the east coast of New Zealand is probably not the best place to be building coastal properties. And yet we see time and time again people putting, not mitigating the risks that they should perhaps be mitigating. And in light of the fact that we are seeing more and more climatic global events, regardless of what they're caused by, you know, there's going to be an increasing incidence of flooding, of earthquakes, of hurricanes, or, you know, these sorts of things. So we need to be mitigating some of these problems for ourselves. Climate change is the number one risk to the insurance industry now. And so I believe that we really do need to find our own national solution for insurance, because when things get bad enough, the first people to leave New Zealand will be the insurers. So, you know, we have to find a way of mitigating these risks for ourselves. And I think one of the ways in doing this is to redefine the role of the current Earthquake Commission, which started out well in 2010, but is, you know, failing abysmally now. And I think there needs to be far more public awareness of the role of EQC and what a well-functioning EQC might look like, and how they might be able to assist the New Zealand situation. Yeah, so I think what we need is a system that protects the citizens of New Zealand. And currently what I see are systems that don't work towards the protection of their citizens. I mean, citizens here in Christchurch are having to fight for every last cent of money that they're actually entitled to. And I think that's really wrong.
Mm. Sounds like serfdom.
Yeah, it feels like it sometimes. And yet, you know, I noticed that IAG in 2012 reported profits of $105 million before tax. All of the insurers to date, you know, they're in the green. They're making plenty of money off of this. And we see the new introduction of fixed sum insurance. And probably the rest of New Zealand hasn't taken much note of these things, but that's going to have dramatic impacts on the amount of premium you're paying. And the reality is it will also affect, in the event of a natural disaster, policyholders will find themselves out of pocket even more, because fixed sum insurance is certainly not the panacea for all of the problems that we've had in Christchurch.
You know, it's a terrible story. You know, my sister lives in Christchurch and told her to get out, but she won't. And here's the thing as well. It's the second largest city in the country. Mm. It's practically being left to the dogs in
in Parliament, in the companies, that kind of thing, and the people just being left out. I heard that the red zones basically are off limits to protests as well, you know, like the general city gathering areas where protesters normally gather together for big marches and what have you. That's off limits. So there are so many things happening to the people of Christchurch right now. It's like being in an Iron Maiden, and every single spike that's inside this this coffin that you've wrapped in is designed specifically to penetrate some vital organ of people's liberty and democracy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we're seeing a very rapid abuse of our democratic rights, and charter schools is a perfect example of that. And for me, charter schools really represent the risk to democracy. You know, we've got a whole population saying, well, no, we don't want this. And yet there's a clear evidence that the national government will push this through, despite the fact that there are many good reasons for not wanting such a change. The situation here sometimes feels hopeless, and I find it very extraordinary that there's so much emphasis placed by Sarah on rebuilding the central business district, and yet there are so many disaffected residents in Christchurch itself and the wider regions, and yet they're pretty much left to their own devices.
Now, Sarah, lastly, just very quickly, what is the name of your book and where can people get a copy?
The book is called The Christchurch Fiasco, The Insurance Aftershock. It's available in Paperplus, Whitcalls, it's published by Dunmore on the Dunmore website, and I have a really active blog called The Christchurch Fiasco.
All right, thank you. Sarah Miles, see you again sometime.
Great, Vinny. Nice to talk to you.